Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and Stacy's Bookstore. I'm Wendy Takuda, your quarterly chair. Before proceeding further, it is my pleasure to welcome any new members who are here today. I know you'll enjoy your membership, and we're going to be looking forward to seeing you often. If you're not yet a Commonwealth Club member, we invite you to consider joining. There is membership available to you as you leave. Following the program, our staff will be happy to answer any questions that you might have and to help you with your enrollment. Now, a few of our upcoming programs. There are several of particular interest, and for a full accounting of those, I refer you to our weekly publication, The Commonwealth, which is available in the reception area. Tomorrow evening, Wednesday, join us as we welcome His Excellency Jaswant Singh, Foreign Minister of India, who will address our membership at a special meeting at 6:30 p.m. That will be at the Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill. On Thursday evening, we will kick off a three-part series on marine conservation with the California Academy of Sciences at Golden Gate Park. The first program to be held at the Academy at 7:30 p.m. will feature underwater explorer Sylvia Earle. And on Tuesday, September 26th, we begin another three-part series, this one on cyber politics, with a program that looks at the impact of online campaigning. This program will be here at the club offices. It will begin with a reception at 6:15 p.m. You may make reservations for all of those programs here after the meeting today by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line, or you can visit the website at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is being taped for later distribution to public and commercial stations on the Commonwealth Club's nationwide radio network. You may hear these broadcasts locally at 8 p.m. every Friday on KQED FM and on Coit AM and FM every Sunday morning at 6. There are question cards on your chairs for today's question and answer session, and our staff will be collecting those throughout the program. I'm going to pause right now for a few minutes to allow our engineer to start the taping for radio. And now I'll introduce our speaker today. Howard Kurtz has been a reporter for The Post since 1981. He covers the media in his regular column called Media Notes. Before that, he served as the New York bureau chief covering the Koch administration and Donald Trump's growing empire. Every week he hosts a program called Reliable Sources, that's on CNN, and it critiques the work of journalists. He also answers questions online on Mondays in his column called Media Talkback, so he is everywhere. He is a best-selling author. Spin Cycle, his last book, Spin Cycle Inside the Clinton Propaganda Machine, talked about the Clinton White House and how it dealt with scandal and the press. He has also written a book on the talk show explosion called Hot Air, All Talk, All the Time. And his first book was called Media Circus, The Trouble with America's Newspapers. Well, you get a sense here from the titles where he's going here. That was voted, by the way, best recent book by the media by the American Journalism Review. Today he is here to talk about his new book, which has already hit number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. The book is called The Fortune Tellers, His Focus, The Reporters and the Commentators Who Cover Wall Street, the Stock Market, and Whose Stories Can Make a Stock Catch Fire or Crash and Burn. For 18 months, he has been following some of the most well-known and influential people in the business, including Jim Cramer, Christopher Byron, Lou Dobbs, analyst Abby Joseph Cohen, and Henry Blodgett. And as his trademark, Howard Kurtz focuses a critical eye on the media here. The conflicts of interest, the carelessness of some who report rumor and misinformation, the egos, we're all waiting to hear about that, Howard, and the cozy relationships, you know, the dish. He is considered by many to be the best media reporter in the business. Will you please welcome author and reporter Howard Kurtz.
Thank you very much. I've got to figure out how to make this a little higher. Great to be here in San Francisco during this cool and refreshing weather, and nice of all of you to come. Now, let's be honest. How many of you are here because you're deeply interested in me as an author, and how many just want to make a quick buck? Well, under SEC regulations, I must request that all cell phones and beepers be turned off, no calling your broker in the middle of this talk. Now, in case you think that stock market analysts know everything, consider this. At the beginning of this year, Byron Wien of Morgan Stanley went on television, where else, to say that this fall, Bill Bradley would defeat John McCain for the presidency. I hope that his portfolio does well in the Bradley administration. If you're interested in the stock market at all, and who isn't these days, you've probably spent some time watching CNBC. And you've probably noticed that it's not unlike a sports network. There's a pregame show, an opening bell, a color man, a starting lineup, lots of statistics, a halftime report, and a postgame wrap-up. It's about putting points on the board in the form of higher stock prices. Every day, somebody wins and somebody loses. All this is no accident. CNBC is consciously modeled on ESPN's SportsCenter. And some of its biggest fans include Charles Barkley, Johnny Bench, John Elway, and Andre Agassi, who are not just jocks, but very rich jocks. When it comes to financial advice, CNBC is no slam dunk. That's because the network, while it has some very good reporters, turns over its airwaves to a steady parade of fund managers and Wall Street analysts whose advice is not only contradictory, but often turns out to be flat wrong. And because financial journalists everywhere do something that is rarely allowed in other parts of the news business, they report rumors on the self-justifying theory that rumors move the market. And because the fortune tellers, some of whom have become celebrities, have blatant conflicts of interest that are rarely discussed. You see these flaws in all the financial media. The financial magazines, for example, from Money to Smart Money to Fortune to Forbes. I brought along just a few recent covers. Some of you may be familiar with this. Here's Money Magazine, Today's Hottest Tech Stocks, Abby Cohn's Top Stocks, Smart Money, 10 Best Mutual Funds. They rack up big returns year after year. Money Magazine, 7 Best New Funds, All-Star Investors. They've got Shaq on the cover. Yes, these jocks really do know their stocks. And the funny thing is that when the same magazines come out in 6 months or a year, all these hot stocks and funds have been replaced by other hot stocks and funds because you can't sell magazines by trumpeting the same stocks that you did in last month's or last year's issue. You also see this culture I'm talking about in the explosion of internet sites from thestreet.com to cbsmarketwatch.com to something called jagnotes.com, which includes a page called The Rumor Room, which I'll talk about more later, to CNN, CNN-FN, Bloomberg, and other television outlets. They all have a vested interest, it seems to me, in trotting out experts in trumpeting the hottest stocks, the best mutual funds, the surefire investment that can make you rich tomorrow if only you subscribe, tune in, or log on. CNBC, though, is the 1,000-pound gorilla of business news, and each day is kind of cast as an episode of Who Wants to Be a Zillionaire? Only there are no lifelines, and if you lose, Regis doesn't just send you home. You take a major hit to your bank account. Turns out it's not so easy to make a pile of dough on Wall Street, at least not as easy as the self-proclaimed gurus would have you believe. Well, my first up-close and personal encounter with Wall Street was on October 19, 1987. I was a New York bureau chief for the Washington Post, and like most Americans, I didn't know a heck of a lot about the stock market. But the market was crashing, and my assignment for the day was to hang with a trader who was trying to save his rear end as Wall Street seemed to be collapsing. I wound up spending the afternoon with a fellow named John Mulhern, who seemed to me to be icy cool as the market plunged by 22% and he was losing millions of dollars. Now, months later, Mulhern was arrested for waving a gun and threatening to kill legendary trader Ivan Boesky, whom he believed had implicated him in an insider trading case. Wall Street, I concluded, was one crazy place. Well, in those days, few ambitious reporters wanted to cover business. It seemed like a backwater realm of dry statistics and quarterly earnings reports. Fortune and Forbes were considered kind of trade publications. There were a handful of business shows on the air, such as CNN's Moneyline, but otherwise television avoided the whole arena unless there was a market crash or some other calamity. The journalistic action was in politics, crime, sports, anywhere but business. By the time I began work on the fortune tellers inside Wall Street's game of money, media, and manipulation, the landscape had been utterly transformed. Business journalism was hot. Nearly everyone cared about Wall Street thanks to 401k retirement plans and online trading and a cultural revolution in which half of American families were now invested in the market. New financial magazines and websites were springing up seemingly by the hour. CEOs like Jeff Bezos, Steve Case, and Meg Whitman had become cult figures. Two cable networks, CNBC and CNN-FN, covered the markets every burp all day long, and celebrities from William Shatner to Phil Jackson to Don Rickles and Lily Tomlin were making dot-com commercials. Even Howard Stern was on the air talking about the market. You couldn't get on an airplane without seeing the latest Dow and NASDAQ numbers flashing on the seat in front of you. All of which raised for me some rather intriguing questions. Who among this steady parade of analysts, fund managers, commentators, experts, and prognosticators could we really trust? Was this explosion of financial advice really worth a damn? And what role did journalists play in a world where every hiccup could send a stock hurtling toward the stratosphere or into the toilet? Now, journalists, to be sure, are important in the world of politics. In my last book, Spin Cycle, which I had the brilliant foresight to publish right after the Monica Lewinsky story broke, actually, it was a lucky accident, Bill Clinton and Al Gore and the White House staff spent endless amounts of time trying to influence the press. But no single reporter has a great deal of power to set the political agenda. But in the financial realm, business reporters are players. What they say moves stocks instantly. But they get spun too, and just as important, they are too often a conveyor belt for passing on the spin of Wall Street hotshots. The results aren't always pretty. The advice served up by these fortune tellers is not only contradictory and not only wrong. Almost no one predicted the painful crash last April that permanently damaged many internet companies and probably cost some of you some money. But almost no one in the media holds these folks accountable. The press often fails to blow the whistle on blatant conflicts of interest, as Wall Street analysts tout the stocks of companies that their own firms are either doing banking business with or hoping to snag as clients. The talking heads themselves are often influenced by cozy relationships with their sources. That's true in other fields as well, but financial journalists with their scoops and their stories can slice billions of dollars off a company's market value in a matter of minutes. Here's an example. Last March, reporter Steve Frank said on CNBC's Business Center that eBay and Yahoo were holding secret talks about a partnership and possibly a merger. While Frank cautioned that his anonymous source put the odds of a partnership at no more than 50-50, eBay soared in after-hours trading from $211 to $235 a share. But the next morning, on CNBC's morning show Squawk Box, Steve Frank was forced to backtrack. London's Financial Times was reporting that the talks had broken down the previous week. These two companies talk all the time, Frank said. All these companies talk all the time. What then was the big exclusive? Well, the market got the message by the end of the day. eBay had dropped 21 points and Yahoo more than 10 points. If you bought at that time, before the plunge, obviously you were out of luck. And the deal, by the way, never happened. Well, just the other week, Bloomberg News, followed by Dow Jones, TheStreet.com, and other business news heavyweights, got badly taken in by a criminal hoax. Bloomberg reported, as many of you may know, on a press release from a fiber optics company here in California called Emulex. Still sounds like a laxative to me. Saying that its CEO had resigned, that it planned to reduce its earnings for the last 2 years, and it was under government investigation. Pretty serious stuff. Emulex stock dropped a staggering 62% in 15 minutes. But the press release was a total fake. Did Bloomberg or Dow Jones or anyone make a phone call to the company to confirm this was an actual press release before telling the world about this bogus news? No, because no one wants to get scooped, even by seconds, in this hyper-competitive world. Now, not too long ago, a former employee of an internet PR service was charged in the scam, which cost investors $2.5 billion. Now, I describe in The Fortune Tellers how Bloomberg was a victim of a false story about two other companies supposedly merging that one employee floated on a fake Bloomberg webpage without Bloomberg's knowledge. You would think the news service would have learned from that incident that these things need to be double-checked. Here's another example. Henry Blodgett, star analyst for Merrill Lynch and a major internet cheerleader, urges people to buy eToys, and the stock drops by 95%. Blodgett urges people to buy Amazon. He became famous, in fact, just a couple of years ago by predicting a great surge for Amazon, which took place in the great dot-com craze of 98 and 99. But this year, Amazon stock has dropped by two-thirds, down even below the level of Henry Blodgett's 1998 prediction. Finally, he downgraded it slightly after many other analysts had done so. But the next time Blodgett is on television, is he grilled about having been wrong on Amazon or eToys? No, because television cares only about what these stocks are going to do today and tomorrow and next week. And television needs a steady parade of wise men to pontificate about the market. What more? Ralph Acampora, the raging bull at Prudential Securities, makes broad predictions about the direction of the market. Summer of 99, Acampora predicted that the Dow, which was then around 11,000, would hit 12,005 to 13,000 by the end of the summer. Well, when that didn't happen, he said the Dow would reach 13,000 by the end of the year. But last fall, when the market ran into some turbulent weather, Acampora did a U-turn and said the Dow could drop as low as 8,900. Well, that never happened. Then Acampora turned bullish again when the Dow finished 1999 a little under 11,500. Ralph said it could hit as high as 14,000 by the end of this year. Well, we're about 3,000 points from there right now. By the way, Acampora also said the NASDAQ would hit 5,000 by the end of this year. And that happened within weeks. And then the NASDAQ crashed down almost to 3,000 before clawing its way back to 4,000. And it's now below that level again as well. Now, Ralph Acampora tells me that he's like a weatherman who has to change his forecast when it starts to rain or snow. Others see him as a weather vane turning with the wind. Maria Bartiromo, the CNBC reporter, perhaps better known as the Money Honey, has the power, as one person told me, to make stocks dance. Nobody works harder. I've watched her work the phones in her little glass booth right above the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, chatting up sources until the second she goes on the air. And when Bartiromo does, what she does is trumpet in the crucial 90 minutes before the opening bell the upgrades and downgrades of Wall Street firms. Now, as we've seen with Blodgett and many others, these downgrades often come long after the stock is in the toilet. And the upgrades are often wrong. Morgan Stanley or Payne Weber or Goldman Sachs predict the stock will go up. Maybe it goes up. Maybe it goes down. Bartiromo, like other journalists, never comes back with any kind of scorecard. She just reports the next day's haul of hot information. You know, if you follow the Giants or the A's, you know who's a 250 hitter. Harder to tell that in this world. So Maria, in many ways, is the queen of Wall Street, but she is also, in some ways, a captive of the street. Still, her influence is enormous. One of those watching her reports closely is Jim Cramer, the wild and crazy Wall Street trader and co-founder of TheStreet.com. Early one morning, Cramer's Merrill Lynch broker called him with the news that the firm was upgrading Micron Technology, which makes semiconductor products. That's going to be huge, Cramer said, even though the analyst was some no-name he'd never heard of. Why, said the broker, we're not really important on Micron. Yeah, said Cramer, but somebody at your company speaks to Maria Bartiromo. Well, Cramer's hedge fund was sitting on 100,000 shares of Micron. And just as Jim Cramer had anticipated, Bartiromo quickly touted the Merrill upgrade. And soon after the market opened, Micron jumped 3 points, and Cramer dumped 15,000 shares, knowing that lots of buyers would be coming in riding the Bartiromo wave. This was absurd, he thought. Investors will sort out the truth. The stock quickly crested, began falling back to earth. Cramer bought back the shares after Micron had dropped 3 points back near its original price. Now that Maria's hype was gone, he turned a quick $45,000 profit by calibrating the power of CNBC. I hasten to add, don't try this at home. Columnist Dan Dorfman often touts possible mergers on jagnotes.com, one of a slew of new financial websites, which includes, as I mentioned earlier, a rumor room. In one story, Dorfman wrote, reports are buzzing on Wall Street that the Chase Manhattan Corp is in exploratory talks to buy brokerage kingpin Merrill Lynch and Company. CNBC quickly declared that rumor untrue, but no matter, Merrill Lynch stock jumped 21% over the next 2 days. Well, 2 months later, the Wall Street Journal's Heard on the Street column said that talk is again swirling on Wall Street that Merrill Lynch was open to some kind of deal with either Chase Manhattan or a company called American International Group. We're still waiting for that to happen. Business Week columnist Gene Marshall often gives stocks a mighty bump with his Inside Wall Street column. When Marshall talked up a firm called Earthlink Network, its share zoomed by 263% the next day. But the Marshall effect can quickly wear off, especially when he cites fund managers who are obviously trying to pump up their stocks. Marshall quoted one investor as saying that a firm called Graphics Zone would become one of the biggest music sites on the web. Over the next 6 months, the stock dropped by 88% and was booted out of the NASDAQ index. But I haven't gotten to the most interesting part of the fortune tellers. My extensive painstaking research has uncovered one of the most striking features of Wall Street. Half the people there can't stand the other half. You know, for all the billion-dollar bets and the limos lined up outside and the traders in their $3,000 Italian suits shouting into their cell phones, Wall Street resembles nothing so much as a snooty high school, with all these little cliques whispering and gossiping about everyone else. Take Jim Cramer, probably the most fascinating character I have ever written about. He trades stocks, he talks about stocks, he writes about stocks 7 or 8 times a day in his column for TheStreet.com, where he is the majority stockholder, and in his column for New York Magazine. Sometimes he gets into ethical scrapes over these multiple roles. Cramer made a bundle off dot-com stocks last year, but his own internet company, TheStreet.com, has plummeted in value from $71 a share when it went public to around $8 a share now. Now, Cramer is a guy who wants to tell you what he thinks about the market every minute. And I often say that if there was no TV and no internet, he'd come to your house. He'd go door to door. Cramer also loves a good fight. He doesn't like CNBC, which booted him off the Squawk Box program last year. He doesn't like Fox News Channel, which aired the Street.com show until a couple of months ago when Cramer helped yank the program and he and Fox wound up suing each other. He doesn't like Dow Jones, where he was once a dissident stockholder taking on management. He had a huge fight with his best friend Marty Peretz, the owner of the New Republic and the other founder of the Street.com. The two savaged each other for months. He doesn't like Dan Dorfman or Gene Marshall, and he ridicules them in his columns. He used to like Maria Bartiromo, but now he's soured on her. And he doesn't like Alan Abelson, the veteran columnist for Barron's. Here's what Cramer says about Abelson. What I cannot stand is the arrogance of the man who leads off Barron's every week and the contempt with which he holds those of us who have been right instead of wrong. His scorn of those of us who have gotten it right and made money these last 15 years that he has been a bear is utterly contemptible. Stop his ravings from polluting another year of financial journalism. Well, here's what Abelson says about Jim Cramer. Cramer, the television personality, an unfailing and formidable threat to coherence. Cramer, the writer, a threat to objective journalism since he's an unremitting practitioner of subjective journalism with only one subject, himself. Cramer, the hedge fund manager, manifestly a threat to the financial well-being of his limited partners. He was, says Abelson, someone who never stops talking but never says anything. But it's not just Jim Cramer. Mark Haynes, the acerbic host of Squawk Box, has a rather low opinion of Ralph Acampora. Whenever Acampora makes a forecast, Haynes and his crew are merciless. There goes Ralph again. What does he know? Wasn't he wrong the last time? And this makes Acampora very, very mad. People like Haynes, he says, have turned market coverage into a carnival. They have no concept of what he does, which is called technical analysis. He's always wrong, always a jerk. Mark Haynes, just a mad dog, says Ralph. Acampora got so angry, in fact, that first he complained to CNBC, and then he started boycotting the network, and the feud goes on. And there are battles within networks as well. Squawk Box, if you haven't seen it, is a very funny show. Mark Haynes and his sidekicks, who are nicknamed Kahuna and the Brain, sit around and talk about Star Trek or Wendy's hamburgers. When Krispy Kreme went public, they scarfed down the donuts on the set. And when Heinz announced it was making green ketchup, they put on blindfolds and did a taste test to see if they could tell green ketchup from red. And for the record, they all failed. And they make fun, unlike many other programs and many other websites and many other magazines, of Wall Street analysts. When a bunch of analysts downgrade a stock, they show footage of a group of penguins waddling along in unison. But some months ago, the ratings dipped a bit, and CNBC management cracked down. No more fooling around, they said. No more goofy videotapes. No more penguins. And Mark Haynes and company were ticked off. They began making subversive little comments on the air, like you do when the teacher's back is turned in school. They complained that CNBC was being run by a bunch of former local news guys. What did they know about business? And they were ordering up a local format complete with a weatherman. And the gang began saving the emails that were pouring in from their fans. I just happen to have a few here. Whosever bright idea it was to ruin Mark Haynes, Kahuna, and the Brain, it's going to backfire. You guys might as well jump off the iceberg if there's no humor left. Bring back the penguins, the Brain, and Kahuna. If I want solemn, business-like presentations, I can watch CNN-FN. And my favorite, congratulations. You've made Squawk Box as dull as a Bob Dole infomercial on penile dysfunction. Well, management got the message, lifted the ban, and the ratings reached new heights. Now, there's one other thing that the fortune tellers has in common with my last book, Spin Cycle, The Art of the Leak. Only instead of Clinton White House aides, it's corporate CEOs and their flacks whispering to their favorite reporters in an effort to shape the coverage. Take the big internet advertising firm DoubleClick. When DoubleClick CEO Kevin O'Connor was buying a company called Abacus for $1 billion, give or take a few spare change, he had his spokeswoman leak the news to a Wall Street Journal reporter. That produced a favorable story that got O'Connor booked on CNBC, CNN-FN, and Bloomberg TV the next morning. Just a few weeks later, when DoubleClick was buying another firm called NetGravity, O'Connor called the same play. The news was leaked to the same Wall Street Journal reporter, which produced another favorable story with a suitably upbeat quote from Kevin O'Connor. The thing about these leaked stories is that critics are almost never quoted because the reporter doesn't want to risk losing the exclusive by calling around for the reaction. And, of course, the companies just love that. Now, don't get me wrong. There are, without question, plenty of honest, hardworking journalists digging up good information from the far corners of the business world. And there are plenty of investors who have smartly used such information to make lots of money in this long bull market. But it would be a significant improvement if more media outlets resisted the temptation to engage in hype and rumor mongering in an attempt to stand out from the crowd. The broader problem may be the self-promotional drumbeat sounded by so many of these outfits, the notion that only they can give you the greatest mutual funds, the best deals, the hottest tips, the shortest route to tomorrow's big payoff. Yes, they provide solid information, and yes, some of it is valuable. But they are also acting as carnival barkers trying to drag consumers inside the tent with the promise of death-defying stunts. The good news is that the internet age, the communications revolution, has allowed the average person sitting at home with a modest 401k plan access to the same lightning-quick information that used to be available only to the high-powered Wall Street insiders. But ordinary folks must understand that this information is sometimes suspect, sometimes tainted, sometimes little more than gossip. The market, after all, is inherently unpredictable, and betting on the fortune tellers is risky business. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Howard Kurtz, media reporter for The Washington Post, author of The Fortune Tellers. At this time, Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Wendy Jakuta, our quarterly chair. And now, Mr. Kurtz, we have a large number of questions. So if you would join me back up here at the podium, we'll begin. In writing The Fortune Tellers, what was your methodology? How much actual work in the field was part of your research?
As my wife can attest, I spent a lot of time up in New York, away from home, doing this research. My goal in The Fortune Tellers was to try to write an interesting tale about what it is actually like either to be a financial journalist or a Wall Street trader or a Wall Street analyst, and how these sort of worlds intersect and all the pressure that these people operate under. I mean, it's really remarkable because so much money is at stake. And so I spent a lot of time with people like Jim Cramer, with people like Christopher Byron, the financial columnist, at CNBC in Fort Lee, New Jersey, watching how these programs are made, interviewing people like Ron Insana and Maria Bartiromo and David Faber and Mark Haynes, at CNN watching Moneyline be put together. There's a chapter in the book that talks about how they decide what goes on the air, the meetings they have internally, talking to people like Ralph Acampora and Henry Blodgett who make markets move with, you know, the merest whisper. And so I obviously wasn't there all the time, but I spent a lot of time emailing and on the phone with these people, looking, vacuuming up as much information as I could. In short, this is a book of reporting. I offer you my analysis. You can reject it or accept it, but it's The Fortune Tellers is a book that takes you behind the scenes to give you a sense of what it is really like. It's a very human business for all the money at stake. And the pressure that these folks operate under is like nothing I've seen in any other part of journalism. I mean, if a political reporter gets a story wrong or speculates about George W. Bush or Al Gore, he looks silly. Maybe it's a flap that ends up on CNN. Maybe if it's a really big story, somebody goes down a half a point in the public opinion polls. When you're wrong about Emulex, when you're wrong about Microsoft, when you're wrong about any of these big company stocks, boom. I mean, investors get punished in a major way. Lots and lots of money is at stake. So this is an attempt to bring you behind the scenes and show you how the sausage is made, so to speak, in the financial media world.
Have most business journalists had the training of other journalists, and do the same ethics apply here?
I've met a lot of smart people who are business journalists. Some of them on television are just former plain old garden variety, former local TV journalists who used to cover fires and murders and, you know, film at 11 and all that kind of stuff, but who have, you know, crossed over to work for a place like CNN, FN, or CNBC or Bloomberg, learn the business. I didn't find any stupid financial reporters because they wouldn't last very long. Others are people who have either studied business or work for trade publications like Institutional Investor and have moved up the ranks to become, you know, reporters for the Wall Street Journal or CNBC or other, big-time news organizations. So I don't think a lack of knowledge is the problem at all. Now, the second part of the question was about ethics. Now, obviously, financial journalists see themselves as every bit as ethical as every other part of the business. And I found almost no instances, there are a couple of rare exceptions, where anybody was either corrupt or in any way trading stocks or talking about stocks that they trade. That is not a significant problem. Where I do think that financial journalists don't hold themselves to the same standards as the rest of the business, although the rest of the business, as I write about in my other life, often fails to meet those standards as well, is in this whole area of reporting rumors, engaging in speculation. And I know the argument because I've had it with a lot of financial journalists. Their argument is that rumors are moving the market. We have to share those rumors with you, and that, therefore, it's part of our job. But of course, these people have a giant megaphone to bring those rumors, completely unconfirmed, sometimes spread by people with an interest in moving a stock up or down, depending on their position, can spread that instantaneously to millions of people. Quick story, I was on CNBC a couple weeks ago being interviewed to talk about this book. And the anchor, Bill Griffith, told me that just an hour earlier, before I had come on, they had gone on the air with what they called an unconfirmed rumor, which in other parts of the business means something you don't have nailed down and aren't supposed to go with, that Microsoft, whose stock had gone up a couple of points that morning, was unconfirmed, rumored to have settled its federal antitrust suit. Huge story, if true. About a half hour to 45 minutes later, something in that neighborhood, CNBC came back on the air and said that they had reached Microsoft official and that rumor was definitely not true and there was no settlement in the antitrust case. Now, I would argue that CNBC's viewers would have been better served had they not gone with the original rumor, waited the 45 minutes to get the company on the phone, and figure out whether there was any substance here at all. But there is this sort of trigger-finger mentality, not only at CNBC, and CNBC has, in other instances, shown restraint, but that kind of report that lasts about 45 minutes, gets people excited, affects the stock, and turns out not to be true, I think is a pretty good example of what of the kind of rather ephemeral story that financial journalists ought to be avoiding.
Do business journalists invest in the companies they cover?
Every news organization has its own rules. The one rule that almost all significant news outlets have in common is they don't allow any short-term trading. In other words, individual reporters can own stocks. They often own, you know, if you work for the Wall Street Journal, you probably owe Dow Jones stock. I own Washington Post stock because it's part of my retirement plan. But they don't allow you to jump in and out of stocks. And there certainly is a prohibition if you are reporting on, if you are, for example, a reporter who specializes in high tech, then management is not going to allow you to own Microsoft and AOL and Yahoo because obviously all those stocks are affected by what you do every day. Now, there are some exceptions. I mentioned Jim Cramer, who doesn't see himself as a journalist. He is a trader, but he also fulfills a quasi-journalistic function in being a commentator on stocks. He owns lots of stocks. In fact, that's what he talks about. He talks about the stocks he trades. He does disclose it. There have been some instances, as I recount in the book, where he has gotten into trouble. And there are a couple of other exceptions. Microsoft has a website called Money Central, I'm told it's extraordinarily popular, where a couple of the journalists there who write regularly on hot stocks, particularly hot small stocks that might take off, own those very stocks, which I find somewhat troubling. But by and large, that is not a problem in financial journalism as much as some of the other factors that I've outlined here.
In the new media world, aren't the media institutions you investigated themselves part of the corporate world they are reporting on, with a vested interest in a robust economy? How does this influence their reporting?
That is a terrific question. And obviously, in the case of the big media companies, they are very much part of this world. They are, I think it goes beyond whether they have an interest in a robust economy. You could probably argue that most Americans have an interest in a robust economy. But to take CNBC as an example, it is part of General Electric, part of NBC, which is owned by General Electric. CNBC has to report on General Electric stock. I don't think that they either favor it or disfavor it, but they always disclose and they mention it. But also they are constantly, and this is true on CNN and other outlets as well, they're constantly interviewing and parading these people from the various brokerage firms. Well, most of these brokerage firms are public. So when you have people coming on from Merrill Lynch or Payne Webber or Goldman Sachs or Prudential, those companies have stocks that are publicly traded. And they rate each other's stocks. So it can be a very incestuous world, particularly when you have the major networks owned by, let's see, Disney, GE, and now Viacom in the case of CBS. The other thing that's troubling in terms of this, you know, corporate tentacles getting into every part of the economy problem is that CNBC, and this was reported at the time, but not a lot of people paid attention to it, bought a minority stake in a company called Archipelago, which is essentially a minor league stock exchange that's trying to get into the major leagues and compete with places like NASDAQ. How CNBC, which reports on the news, can also be an investor in a company that trades stocks is something that I've never quite figured out, and particularly if this particular company gets to be bigger and its own stock reports are frequently cited on television, like you have somebody stationed at the NASDAQ trading floor, Times Square with those colorful backdrops that you've all probably seen on TV. I think that's tricky, and I know that some folks at CNBC are a little bit concerned about it.
The SEC carefully monitors press releases and earnings report from companies trading their stocks publicly. Is there any corresponding control of analysts and financial observers?
Well, there's no corresponding control of financial journalists, which I think is a good thing because I'm a card-carrying believer in the First Amendment. Whatever problems the financial media have, I don't think they are ones that need to be fixed by the government. But the SEC in particular has gotten very concerned about the role of analysts. And, in fact, I write in the fortune tellers about the editor of Bloomberg News who made it kind of a signature crusade to try to get the SEC to change the rule, which it did just a few weeks ago, adopt a new regulation to try to limit what they call selective disclosure. Now, selective disclosure is when company CEO throws a nice retreat, and it's usually in a place like Palm Springs or Sun Valley, and invites certain analysts from certain firms, and they wine and dine them, and the CEO gives a talk. And they talk sometimes about information of how the company's doing or how next quarter is going to look or how next year is going to look, which is great if you're the analyst and you can go tell your clients, you know, I'm bullish on this stock because I just talked to the CEO and let's buy it. But if you're everybody else, if you're the millions of other investors who are not privy to this kind of whispered or not so whispered information, then you have concerns about a level playing field. When the SEC proposed this rule, the Wall Street firms all hated it and vigorously opposed it, but it did pass. I think it would probably be in practice difficult to enforce. The SEC is also talking about, I don't know they're actually going to take action on this, trying to get analysts in particular when they go on television, go on radio, and go online to talk about what I see as a fairly blatant conflict of interest, that is, which companies that they're evaluating, do their own brokerage firms actually do business with? A lot of these people are in business together. I don't think that necessarily taints their advice. I think consumers have a right to know that. You know, it's no accident that 99.5% of all recommendations by all Wall Street analysts are to buy stocks. I think that's probably the most startling statistic in my book because there are a lot of built-in pressures on analysts not to use the S word, not to tell people to sell. By the time an analyst tells you to sell a stock, it is already heading south. And there are a couple of cases, which I write about, where analysts have actually gotten fired by their own brokerage firms for being too negative, I would say too honest, about the companies they're paid to evaluate.
Mr. Kurtz, this one seems to come from someone who's already read your book. And their question is, sounds like all these media-happy market analysts need to get a report card on their performance. Does anyone do this on a regular basis?
I am all in favor of report cards. And I'm told that there are a couple of websites, although I have not personally checked this out, that make some attempt at rating analysts and giving some kind of scorecard. It's a hard thing to do. Mark Haynes, the host of CNBC Squawk Box, told me that he at home, he does a lot of work on his computer at home, tried to compile a database of all analysts and their recommendations and how they did so that when some of these analysts were either interviewed on CNBC or talked about, they could say, well, you know, this is the same outfit that told us that eToys was a great buy, and then they show one of those charts that shows the thing going straight down. It's a hard thing to do, but I think it's a very possible thing to do, and I think at the very least that media organizations could do a better job of holding accountable the analysts that they're going to bring on TV or that they're going to interview on the website to look at their recommendations and give people a scorecard. Nobody expects these people to bat 1,000. Obviously, the market is unpredictable. Obviously, folks are going to make mistakes. But wouldn't you rather know that somebody's last 9 out of 10 picks turned out pretty well, or at least were keeping pace with the market, as opposed to how you would regard an analyst who perhaps had a batting average more around 500? I think that would be valuable information for consumers. I think that is the kind of thing that is done in other parts of journalism. Certainly when political prognosticators get one wrong, they get razzed about it, probably not enough. And I'd like to see the same kind of scorecard approach adopted by more folks in financial journalism.
What are the most important business stories that are not being covered by the so-called business journalists?
I think business news has become so popular, and there are so many outlets now, and there are so many websites and magazines that do this, that I'm not sure that there are all of these great stories out there that are not being reported on. I think it's more a question of skepticism and perspective. In other words, if you're interested in General Motors stock, you can probably get lots of information, both raw information online and information you could probably see a GM executive being interviewed somewhere, and you could probably see a lot of questions being asked about car production and that sort of thing. What you may not get as much of would be questioning the basic premise of how the market works in the case of GM or any other company. Here's what I mean. It would seem to the layman, which I was a couple of years ago when it came to this world, I mean, I knew about as much as any informed newspaper and magazine reader, that if a company, again, I'm just using GM as a hypothetical example, reported profits that were twice as high as a year ago, that company was doing pretty well. That would be a company you might want to invest in for the short term. The stock must be heading up. Well, it turns out that what has an even greater impact on stock prices is these estimates and even sub rosa estimates that are called whisper numbers, I love that phrase, that are issued by Wall Street analysts of how they think the stock is going to do, how they think the company is going to do when it reports its quarterly earnings reports. So what becomes important here is not just how much money you made and not just how many widgets you sold, but whether you beat the expectations game. And so you have what some people regard as a kind of a cozy sort of manipulation where management gives guidance to the analyst that we're probably going to make about 55 cents a share in the next quarter. The analysts get together and put that out to their clients. Consensus estimate, 55 cents. Along comes General Motors, and they make 57 cents a share. And suddenly, they beat the street. Everybody's excited. The stock goes up. Of course, it also works the other way around. You miss the estimate by a penny, and your stock can get hammered, even though you're putting up good numbers, even though you have a pretty strong company. Now, there may be no way to deal with this psychology of Wall Street, although it just makes me wonder how it is that this relatively finite group of people, some of whom have less than stellar track records, have so much influence that you not only have to do a good job, but you have to beat their estimate of what kind of job you should be doing. Those are the kinds of fundamental questions I'd like to see focused on a little bit more in some corners of business journalism.
Have you found significant changes in the financial publications like Fortune, Forbes, Business Week, and U.S. News and World Report that have been around for eons?
Sure. Everybody's always reinventing themselves. And Fortune magazine, to take one example, I think is an example of a magazine that has gotten much more readable and just much better at what it does over the last, say, decade, and particularly in the last 5 years that I have followed it more closely. The other change that I see, and I also saw this change at the Washington Post, the New York Times, San Jose Mercury News, San Francisco Chronicle, and any other newspaper worth more than a quarter, is enormous amounts of ink, in the case of television airtime, being devoted to the technology sector. And that, I think, is a response to a couple of things. One is obviously the growing importance of technology in our society. Another is the tremendous ride that tech stocks had, at least of 1998 and 1999, obviously having a little tougher time of it today. And finally, I think that writing about, and the magazines in particular, Fortune, for example, what I should just mention, was doing so much internet coverage in what's supposed to be a broad-based business magazine that they spun off a new magazine called eCompany Now. And a lot of these magazines are about, you could kill a small rodent with them because they're so thick with advertising because they're so popular. But what strikes me is that I think all of the media, not just the financial media, and my own organizations included, really did a lot to encourage and whip up the technology hype that got a lot of people swept away in the last couple of years. Jeff Bezos, Times Man of the Year, that sort of thing. And then suddenly, last April, when the NASDAQ took a dive and tech stocks were not so hot and some of these highly touted e-tailers were going out of business, you started to see all these stories in the press about, what were these people thinking? Who believed all this hype about tech stocks? Well, these people are morons. You know, without sort of ever grappling with the fact that they had become, in order to sell magazines and newspapers and to get ratings on TV, part of the hype machine. And I just got, you know, drcoop.com got a million stories written about it until the stock just plummeted. And now, of course, it became a prescription for disaster. So I think sometimes the media, you know, try to have it both ways, get in on the ground floor hype. And then if the hype doesn't pan out, you come and do the story that says, what were these people thinking?
Considering Wall Street spinmeisters, privatization of Social Security, is it a good idea?
Well, I'm not a financial expert and I don't play one on television, so I would answer that question simply by saying I could understand a lot of people wanting to take more control of their financial future and wanting to, I mean, even now in 401k plans, a lot of people have choices that they have to make that they didn't have to worry about 10 years ago, about which fund to invest in, sometimes which individual stock to invest in. So I think that can be very tempting. The cautionary note, as some have observed, is that the stock market involves risk. And I think a lot of us forgot about that, certainly younger people who've sort of only known a bull market in the last 10 years as stocks seem to be a surefire investment, may have regarded, you know, the more difficult market, even of the 1970s, as far away as the Great Depression. And so if such a plan is enacted, and most of the politicians are talking about doing this on a voluntary basis, at least at the outset, I think people need to understand that that can be a great addition to their portfolio, but they are also risking their own money. They've got to make grown-up decisions. They've probably got to do it on a more sophisticated basis than who's the latest chief executive to show up on CNBC. In short, that there is risk involved. So to say whether it's a good or bad idea sort of depends on your tolerance for risk, and it also depends on the shape of any final Social Security privatization law that Congress might pass.
In a Fresh Air interview, you once referred to the media as in a race to be second. I'd love to hear you expand on that concept.
That was a while ago, and somebody must be keeping a scrapbook on me, because I barely remember saying that. But here's what I must have meant. No, I have used that expression on occasion. The context at the time was not financial news, but what we might call tabloid news, sleazy news, sensational news, the kind of news that's become pretty common today in the wake of the Monica story and other sex scandals, the Lorena Bobbitt case, all of those things that, you know, once were kind of the province of the tabloids, and that suddenly we're on the network news and suddenly we're on the front pages of newspapers reading about things in graphic detail that we all never thought that we would. And what I said in that interview was that respectable news organizations, those that don't see themselves as kind of getting down in the gutter to do the latest dish on the latest sex scandal or salacious story, they want to find a way to get this into the paper because that's what people are talking about, because they don't want to lose their readers to television. There's a great fear, particularly among newspapers, about the declining readership over the years. If somebody else does it first, then you're in the great race to be second. Boy, that opens the floodgates. Well, Drudge reported it. Well, it was in the National Enquirer. Well, Inside Edition had something on it, and now we have a responsibility to inform our readers of just what this thing is. Now, all this maybe seems quaint in the wake of the presidential impeachment and the Starr report, but when we didn't have that kind of drama, I do think that there were news organizations, and I sometimes in my role as a media reporter found myself grappling with, do I write about this rumor or sleazy story, similar to the questions that financial journalists face, now that I know that it's been online, it's been on television, it's not something that I can confirm, but maybe I have a duty to my readers to grapple with it, to tell them, is it true, to do some kind of evaluation of the reporting of others. Then, of course, you can be accused of adding to the echo chamber. So I do think that in the advent of websites that love to put this stuff out, true or not, salacious certainly, that it does provide a kind of a backdoor for some more elite media organizations to kind of sneak this stuff through customs and get it out into the mainstream.
How do you get sources to keep talking to you when you are so critical of them?
That's a great question. And it's a question faced by every reporter who's ever covered City Hall or State House or a presidential candidate or the local sewer board, which is to say it's not your job to be a cheerleader for the folks. And at the same time, you don't want to so alienate them if you're a beat reporter that they won't continue to talk to you. I think, using the fortune tellers as an example, I've talked to every one of the major characters in this book, people who I thought were very generous with their time over the course of 2 years in allowing me access to what they did and talking about what they did. And not everybody is happy with everything I say in the book. That's to be expected. But Jim Cramer, Mark Haynes, Chris Byron, Ron Insana, and many others have all told me or told me by email that they thought I was fair, that I represented their point of view, that I criticized where I thought criticism was warranted, but I didn't oversimplify, I didn't pile on. And I think that's all ultimately that any source wants. Wants a chance to be understood, wants a chance to get their viewpoint across, wants to be treated fairly. Understanding, certainly politicians understand this. Journalists, I can tell you, often do not. They much rather have the pen in their hands than be on the other side of the notebook. All that most sources want is a fair shake, and they're willing to take some criticism if they feel like they've been treated with respect and that their point of view has gotten an equal hearing. That's what I've tried to do in my media job. Can't say that everybody I've ever written about has been a huge fan of mine. That comes with the territory. And that's what I try to do in this book. And in this book, I'm very proud of the fact that the main folks who I dealt with very extensively, again, seem to think that this was a fair rendering of their profession.
In your book, Spin Cycle, you write about the Clinton administration's spin machine. How would you rate Governor Bush and Vice President Gore's spin control and press relations during this campaign?
That is something I've spent the better part of a year writing about and reporting on. Now, if you'd asked me that question a month ago, I would have said, based on, I actually wrote a story, a big piece for the Washington Post, where I spent a day on the Bush plane riding around as he campaigned, getting a sense of how the press, how he deals with the press. And he was getting terrific press at that point. The governor had a great personal relationship with the reporters who followed him. He would come to the back of the plane, and he would pinch cheeks, and everybody had nicknames, and he would kid around. And he would also answer serious questions and expose himself to the possibility of making mistakes. And I thought that was a very smart press strategy, and I thought it was in one of the factors, there are obviously many, that was giving him the lead that he had. When I went out with Vice President Gore in Air Force Two, a completely different climate. The reporters were frustrated. The day that I went out, we didn't see Gore at all. That was not unusual. He often went to his events, gave his speeches, sometimes did interviews with local TV reporters, but didn't talk to the national reporters who were following him. And I think that made him seem defensive, inaccessible, and journalists were not able to glimpse the private side of Gore that his friends always said was much less stiff than his public image. Well, in the last month, obviously, the situation has totally changed. Gore has gotten tremendously good coverage, I think largely because he's come up in the polls, and many journalists are poll-driven creatures, and it's kind of like covering a baseball team. When you're on a winning streak, the manager's a genius. Last month, he was a bum. At the same time, because Bush has dropped in the polls, he's basically running the same campaign. He has had a couple of rough weeks. He has made some mistakes. But every mistake he makes, such as calling a reporter a nasty name into an open mic, gets blown up into a huge gaffe, in part because reporters are looking for a metaphor for a campaign that appears to be struggling. So I think the Bush campaign did very well with the press for a year and a half, has not done so well over the last few weeks, and now I think is providing less access to the governor because they're taking a lot of hits in the media. Vice President Gore, the opposite, he seems much more comfortable now talking to reporters and being more open with the media, whereas when he was getting a rough time, he sort of clammed up. I predict this could change again before November. And it is a sort of a political example of the same kind of things we see in the financial world, where companies are more accessible or less accessible, depending on how they think they're being treated by the media organizations with which they deal.
As a follow-up question, has George W. Bush's recent comment about Adam Clymer hurt his relations with the press? And behind closed doors, what was the reaction from reporters about the comment?
I wouldn't say that Governor Bush's comment, everyone in America has now heard it at least 50 times, you know, calling Adam Clymer of the New York Times a major league ass to clean it up just a little bit. I wouldn't say that that has soured his relations with the press in the sense that journalists are so offended that a politician would utter such words about one of their own that they are mad at the governor. I don't see that at all. I do see reporters piling on because they see it's such a rookie mistake to utter that kind of thing anywhere near a microphone. And so I think you see a lot of stories saying, basically, what a dummy to do such a thing. And it's funny. I mean, there's a lot of clutter out there. Not that many stories get through. As I go around and talk to people and people email me, the one story that everyone seems to know about is that story. And that completely stepped on Bush's message, not just that day, but for the next several days. So I think the media reaction has not so much been to be offended. We've all probably been called worse, usually not in front of a microphone, by politicians that we cover, but to feel that it was yet another example in the journalistic parlance of a presidential candidate who was, shall we say, prone to mistakes.
How do the gyrations of the stock market affect the political world? Is the financial community more comfortable with Gore or with Bush?
Well, probably in the world of big business, Governor Bush has more support. Hardly surprising, since many of his positions as governor of Texas were deemed favorable to the business community, less enthusiastic, for example, about environmental regulations than his Vice President Gore. I don't know enough to say about the relative impact on the stock market, but Jim Cramer, the Wall Street trader who we spoke about earlier, wrote in his latest column for New York Magazine that he thinks the stock market will continue to soar under Al Gore if he is elected to continue President Clinton's policies, and will totally tank under George W. Bush. But interestingly, because with Cramer there's always a backstory, he did disclose in the very same column that he is a major Democratic Party contributor and is friendly with Gore and has actually written speeches, this is some years ago, for the vice president. So you can take his advice for what it's worth, just like you can on stocks that he may own, that he would like to see Al Gore elected president. And the truth is, I'm not sure anybody knows in advance whether or not how the election would affect the stock market. After all, there were some Wall Street wise men who said that Clinton's election in 92 was going to be bad news for the stock market, and the market at that time was at about 3,000, and so some of those folks obviously were wrong.
John McCain has serious differences with Governor Bush. Campaign finance reform, pork barreling in the Department of Defense budget, for example. What effect will these and other differences have on Republicans and the election?
Well, I spent a lot of time on John McCain's Straight Talk Express earlier this year. Talk about a great media story. I've never seen a candidate do that at that level with so many journalists. And it was just an interesting lesson in another way of dealing with the press rather than roping them off and keeping them and basically letting handlers talk to them. I don't think it's going to have a huge impact one way or another. John McCain spoke at the Republican convention. He endorsed Governor Bush. The only question, I think, is I don't think any politician, I think McCain would agree with this, can transfer his popularity to another candidate. And those who were most enthusiastic about McCain's message of reform, particularly on campaign finance reform, may vote for Bush. They may just stay home. So I think it is hard to say one way or another whether the McCain factor is going to be much of a factor in this election.
Don't financial journalists play a huge role in boosting candidates' political stocks?
Gee, I always thought that was the province of political reporters and major league reporters who follow these candidates around. On one level, I would say that the picture of the economy and the picture of the stock market painted by financial journalists probably does have what one candidate would call a subliminal effect on people's perception of the election. I mean, if the economy in September and October is still seen as roaring along, that has to help the representative of an incumbent administration, Vice President Gore. If the stock market is suddenly seen to be in trouble as opposed to just going through the usual dips, that I suppose would raise questions for some people about whether or not to stick with the Clinton-Gore team in effect. But, you know, the economy has been so strong for so long, and I say this as somebody who watched the 92 election where the then recession was such a big factor, I think, in President Bush's defeat, that it almost has been taken off the table because I think a lot of voters just assume it's going to be that way forever, and it almost has kind of receded as a frontline issue in a way that doesn't particularly help Gore but doesn't necessarily hurt George Bush.
Unfortunately, we've come to that time in our program where we have time for one last question, and that question is, how do you invest in the market?
had a feeling I was going to get something along these lines. Particularly because I was writing this book, and particularly because I cover a lot of media companies in my job as a newspaper reporter, I have decided to stay away from investing in individual stocks. The only individual stock I own now is Washington Post Company stock, which I get in my retirement plan, and they also pay my salary, so it's probably not any added conflict there. Otherwise, I've mostly invested in funds, which are diversified enough, I think, to spare me any ethical question about whether there's any nexus between what I write about and what I might personally own. And I think a lot of financial journalists, particularly those who are covering the whole broad range of stocks, I think many of them take a similar approach, although I think it's frustrating for them, not so much for me, because if I played the market, I'd probably lose money. But for some of these financial journalists who are very smart about the market, they have told me that they're constantly meeting people who are 10 and 20 years younger than them who are worth 10 and 20 and $30 million in the new dot-com economy. And I know some of them think, and a few of them actually tried this, if they just quit and went to work as a fund manager or joined one of these funds, boy, they could add several zeros to the paycheck. But most of them seem to like the business and decide to stay in it even though it does limit their trading of stocks.
Our thanks to Howard Kurtz, media reporter for The Washington Post and author of the new book, The Fortune Tellers, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those joining us by radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and Stacy's Bookstore is adjourned.